A reading from the book of Ruth. At midnight, the man was startled and turned over, and there lying at his feet was a woman. He said, "Who are you?" And she answered, "I am Ruth, your servant. Spread your cloak over your servant, for you are next of kin." He said, "May you be blessed by the Lord, my daughter. This last instance of your loyalty is better than the first. You have not gone after young men, whether poor or rich. And now, my daughter, do not be afraid. I will do for you all that you ask, for all the assembly of my people know that you are a worthy woman. But now, though it is true that I am a near kinsman, there is another kinsman more closely related than I. Remain this night, and in the morning, if he will act as next of kin for you, good, let him do it. If he is not willing to act as next of kin for you, then, as the Lord lives, I will act as next of kin for you. Lie down until the morning." So she lay at his feet until morning, but got up before one person could recognize another. For he said, "It must not be known that the woman came to the threshing floor." Then he said, "Bring your cloak you are wearing and hold it out." So she held it, and he measured out 6 measures of barley and put it on her back, and then she went into the city. She came to her mother-in-law, who said, "How did things go with you, my daughter?" Then she told her all that the man had done for her, saying, "He gave me these 6 measures of barley, for he said, 'Do not go back to your mother-in-law empty-handed.'" She replied, "Wait, my daughter, until you learn how the matter turns out, for the man will not rest, but will settle the matter today." Hear what God is saying to the people. My friend Mary Jane recently took her young nieces to the movies. They went to see Shaun the Sheep. Toward the end of the movie, when the sheep's nemesis makes his last attack, 5-year-old Evelyn leaned into her aunt and asked, "This comes out all right, doesn't it?" And Mary Jane later reflected that this was a very profound question, one that many wise people have tried to answer. Will our lives, mired as they are in our shared human predicament, come out all right in the end? Many of us find ourselves right now in the middle of stories that, despite their wonderful episodes, may well be puzzling, threatening, and painful. We act, we wait, we hope, as we live right in the middle of our stories. And as people of faith, we live our stories in the light of a broader story, that of God's redemptive and redeeming work, animated by love. Because we are using the readings of the daily lectionary in chapel this year instead of the Sunday lectionary, we find ourselves in the middle of a scriptural story that we may or may not have been following. So did you hear how our lesson just began? At midnight, the man was startled and turned over, and there lying at his feet was a woman. Talk about finding yourself in the middle of a story, right? So this is the story of Ruth and her mother-in-law, Naomi, and a wealthy relative and landowner named Boaz. It's a marvelously crafted short story, one that leaves enough to the imagination to really invite the reader in. Ruth and Naomi, both widows, have left Moab, where their husbands died, and come to Naomi's hometown of Bethlehem. They are poor and they are vulnerable. Naomi says bitterly, "I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. The Lord has dealt harshly with me." Not knowing how their story will end, they have taken the step of coming to Bethlehem. They're hungry, and so Ruth has been gleaning in the barley fields, picking up what the harvesters have left behind. And Boaz, the owner of the barley fields, has noticed her, learned of her loyalty to her mother-in-law Naomi, and has arranged for Ruth to work alongside his own female workers. And he has blessed her efforts with prayer. May the Lord reward you for your deeds, and may you have a full reward from the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come for refuge. But now the harvest is coming to an end, and Ruth and Naomi are trying to figure out what they should do. Naomi comes up with a plan to provide for their ongoing security. She urges Ruth to get all dressed up, to go to Boaz in the middle of the night to propose marriage and see what happens. A bold plan indeed. And Ruth does what her mother-in-law asks. And this is where we find ourselves in the middle of this story. Boaz, not surprisingly, quite startled, asks, "Who are you?" And she replies, "I am Ruth, your servant. Spread your cloak over your servant, for you are next of kin." Spread your cloak over me means take me for your wife. Bold indeed, but resonant for the reader. The word for cloak also means wing. So thus Catherine Dube Schenkenfeld notes, Ruth in effect invites Boaz to make good on the prayer he made on her behalf earlier, that God, under whose wings she has taken refuge, will reward her boldness. She's saying, act to bring the blessing to me that you prayed to God for. Let God work through you. So far, so good. But good stories usually don't have straightforward plots. Boaz doesn't simply accept her proposal. He says he has to check with another relative who seems here to have right of first refusal. Now, apparently the Hebrew terminology used here is somewhat puzzling. The word used for next of kin is one that is used for the one with the right of redemption when you're talking about land transactions, real estate transactions. It's not used anywhere else in the context of marriage. And levirate marriage, the practice of a widow marrying her brother-in-law to maintain a family line, doesn't really fit here, and that practice doesn't use that term either. So following Schenkenfeld again, the general sense seems to be that redeemers, those with the first right of redemption, are those who have a responsibility to care, to help the unfortunate. And thus, again, while the story is focusing on the human actions of Ruth and Boaz here, the redemptive action of God is lurking just beneath the surface. Boaz promises that as the Lord lives, this redemptive role will be played out. Just, he has to follow the procedures that due diligence requires. Boaz then says, "Don't be afraid. Lie down until the morning." And I really wonder how Ruth slept. When it's not quite morning, Boaz sends Ruth home, but not before he fills her cloak with barley. As Ruth reports to Naomi, "He gave me these 6 measures of barley, for he said, 'Do not go back to your mother-in-law empty-handed.'" Empty-handed is how Naomi had described her return to Bethlehem. So this gift of grain confirms Boaz's desire to help Ruth provide for Naomi and is yet another reminder of God's provision coming through human hands. And as we come to the end of our reading, we are still in the middle of the story. Ruth and Naomi have some food. They're hopeful, but they're still vulnerable. Naomi says to Ruth, "Wait, my daughter, until you learn how the matter turns out, for the man will not rest, but will settle the matter today. In other words, we've done what we can, we've asked for help, we've asked for God's provision, we're just going to have to wait and see. Wait and see. How many of us find ourselves in the middle of significant life stories where we can't foresee the end, where we have to wait and see? I see that hand, and I see that hand. There are as many such stories as there are people here in chapel today. Now, like these widows, maybe we're wondering what will become of us when the spouse we've built a life with dies, or goes off with someone else, or gets ill and can't work. Or when we graduate from seminary, will there be a call? Will it be within commuting distance, or will it be a big disruption of having to move the family? Or when this child is born, will she be healthy? Will she make good choices? Will she be safe in the world? Or when will this aging parent die? How much care will be needed, and how much love will be shared along the way? Or what will theological education look like in the coming decades? What shape will our vocations take? As we turn to our gospel reading for this morning, we're once again right in the middle of a story. We're at the Last Supper. Jesus has just washed the disciples' feet and said that he's about to be betrayed. He has dipped a bit of bread into a dish and given it to Judas, who leaves quickly to do what he's going to do. And today's reading begins, "When he had gone out, Jesus said." This being John's gospel, Jesus will have a lot to say, but what we have here is just a few verses that give us three big themes that will soon be elaborated on: glorification, departure, and love. The lifting up of Jesus on the cross is what the readers of John's gospel have been waiting for, what will usher in a decisive new chapter in the story. And so here it comes. "Now the Son of Man has been glorified, and God has been glorified in him. If God has been glorified in him, God will also glorify him in himself and will glorify him at once." Now that Judas has left, now that the events which John's gospel has been building toward are set in motion, now things happen quickly and at once. But notice that Jesus speaks here in the past tense. Now the Son of Man has been glorified, and God has been glorified in him. These events have been decisively set in motion by Judas' departure, and so they're written about as if they are regarded as fulfilled. The story that takes place in John's gospel is taking place with history on one side, the meal, the washing, the betrayal, and the life of the world to come, being with God in a life of abundant fullness on the other. And the readers, including us, live in this middle space, in the middle of the story. Jesus says, "Where I am going, you cannot come." Not yet. But even so, the life-giving events of Jesus' death and resurrection will shape, and indeed are already shaping, John's community. They're acting almost like a magnet, having happened and pulling the community's story forward. The disciples then are exhorted to love one another, to follow the self-giving example of their teacher and Lord who has just washed their feet and is going to the cross. "Just as I have loved you, you also should love one another." The community of Christians lives now in the unfolding story of the life in this world where human actions can do God's work. Animated by love, they simultaneously live in the now of Jesus' glorification, in the everlasting life that comes with the resurrection which draws them onto God, simultaneous with life in this world. As Gerard Sloyan comments, it is the life of Christians now, a frustrating combination of being and becoming, of following Jesus as a disciple, not yet having faced the later on when they shall come after him where he is. Ultimately, this story will come out all right, as Aunt Mary Jane assured young Evelyn, but we're not there yet, and we're not promised a trouble-free plot. So how do we do justice to the reality of our stories as we act and wait and hope in this world, much like Naomi and Ruth, not sure of what is coming? In this world where we may experience meals with friends and painful betrayal in the same day, like Jesus and his disciples, while at the same time faithfully living into the resurrection reality that is already shaping our stories and which will bring them to fulfillment. I think this is a little bit like reading a good historical novel, one which powerfully portrays the tension of living through a story with characters who don't know how it comes out, even if the history itself is well known. Hilary Mantel's books about the English Reformation, Wolf Hall and Bring Up the Bodies, are a good example. The reader knows that Henry VIII will divorce Catherine of Aragon and marry Anne Boleyn. The reader also knows that Anne herself will be cast aside and beheaded. Those who facilitate these events, like the main character Thomas Cromwell, are promoting religious change at the same time they're helping the king. Now, the reader knows that the Anglican Church, independent of Rome, will endure well past Henry's reign. But in the middle of the story, the actors who are bringing about this religious change didn't know what would become of themselves or their movement. Mantel conveys this sense of fluidity, uncertainty, and human agency very effectively, all the while presenting the story that ends just as we know it will. When my husband and I got engaged, his grandmother gave us a Bible, King James Version, giant print, Words of Christ in red, with special pages in the front to record family events. She herself wrote on the presentation page. And then the Bible has a page for recording holy matrimony, and then another for the wife's family tree, and another for the husband's family tree. And then there are pages that are headed births, marriages, deaths. The practice of recording family events in a family Bible is a way of acknowledging that our stories are attached to this greater story, this story of God's redemptive and liberating work, as we live in hope, animated and drawn by love. In church history this week, we're reading from Bernard of Clairvaux's treatise on loving God. This 12th century Cistercian monk, mystic, and preacher, one of the saints we could put on a little sticky around the chapel, this man reminds us that it is God who enables our love on all levels, our love for ourselves, for one another, and for God. In his poetic prose, Bernard writes, God satisfies with good things. God incites to good, maintains in goodness, anticipates, sustains, fulfills. God makes you desire. God is what you desire. God offers the opportunity, creates the affection, and consummates the desire. God serves himself as food for holy souls. And Bernard is moved to pray, O Lord, you are so good to the soul who seeks you. What must you be to the one who finds you? More wonderful still, no one can seek you unless that one has already found you. you wish to be found, that you may be sought for, and sought for to be found. And so here we are, seeking and finding, living in the middle of our individual stories, in the middle of our community's stories, where we seek God and where God has found us. As we come to the table, we bring these stories into God's greater story. We rehearse salvation history. We remember the stories of those like Ruth who have gone before us and are part of the great cloud of witnesses. We affirm the decisive events John recorded for us. Christ has died. Christ is risen. Christ will come again. We remember the love given us as Jesus served at the table and went to the cross, dying to overcome death that we might live. And we bring ourselves as living sacrifices, offering our thanks and praise. We look forward to the fulfillment of our various stories in the great story, when the love that we haltingly enact now will be our joyful delight, when Jesus comes in glory and we will celebrate victory with him. Amen.